This reading is from The Purpose of Traveling by Gregory Rodriguez. So that one day you realized what you wanted had already actually happened long ago in the dwelling place in which you lived before you began. Every step along the way, you had carried the heart and the mind and the promise that first set you off and then drew you on. And that you were more marvelous in your simple wish to find a way than the gilded roofs of any destination you could reach.
I just wanted to give credit where credit was due. That's actually by David White, a poet, and we got a little confused in the readings this morning. It's a beautiful poem called The Journey. And thank you so much for having me today. My mom is fond of saying that we don't change much. In her view, who we were as kids, even as little toddlers, is who we still are today as, heaven help me, senior citizens. It's kind of deflating, I must admit, when I walk through my entire life's journey thinking it is about growing and changing, self-actualization, particularly when the very core spiritual belief that's kept me afloat nearly my entire adult life would say that it is indeed about growing. And to a deeper experience and understanding of our oneness, mutuality, kinship, to use Father Greg Boyle's word, and that the pathway to that mutuality is one of intimacy and connection, and an old-fashioned religious word, communion, stepping out, reaching toward the other. But we don't live in an either-or world, do we? We live in a both-and world. So I suppose there's room for both ideas to be true. In describing each of her three kids, my mom would characterize me, among other things, as the explorer. I was a little surprised by that when she shared it with me not too long ago because it's not a label with which I ever would have identified. But she reminds me that my idea of fun at age 10 or so on a Sunday afternoon would be to buy an unlimited all-day bus pass on the Long Beach Municipal bus lines and just get on the bus and ride to wherever. Exotic destinations like Artesia or Paramount. I do love to travel. There's no doubt about that. I would spend my last nickel on a trip to some exotic destination, and very nearly have. Still, I'm struck by this paradox between the idea that there's somewhere to go and something to become, and yet we don't change. Caught in our own caste system, perhaps, by design. Instead of buying into the assumption that it is all about growing and changing, aiming towards some vague fantasy of perfection, maybe it's really just about becoming more of who we are and falling in love with that. Even Dorothy Gale offered us that wisdom nearly 80 years ago in The Wizard of Oz. If I ever go looking for my heart's desire again, I'll never look further than my own backyard. Because if it isn't there, I never really lost it to begin with. So what do we make then of the whole concept of pilgrimage? It's a word that has religious and spiritual connotations, to be sure, but we make pilgrimages for all kinds of reasons. Maybe to prove something to ourselves or others. I have a patient, Raphael, in his 20s, who has an aggressive sarcoma, and he recently climbed to the top of Mount Whitney, in part just to prove to himself that he could, that the cancer hadn't completely defeated him. It was also a way, as he saw, to honor all those he'd met along the way who would never have been able to make such a climb. He'd carry them in his heart while he walked. Well, that is most certainly a pilgrimage. We might make a pilgrimage to find something, spiritual inspiration, awakening, renewal. We might make a pilgrimage to return to something, a childhood home, an ancestral burial ground. For me, I think pilgrimage is ultimately about connecting to something, something within, something without, internal and external pilgrimages. Of course, a pilgrimage needn't necessarily even be intentional. Life has a way of sending us on a journey without so much as asking our permission. Cancer would be such a journey, a pilgrimage towards spiritual essence, if you will, of discovery of who I am if I'm not all those things I did, all those things I thought I was. Richard had been a brilliant, highly esteemed engineering professor, and he now has a brain tumor. Michael, I used to be smart. That's who I was. But I'm not smart anymore. I can't find the simplest word to finish an easy sentence. And I've never really been what you'd call a people person. I've never really had friends to speak of, and that's been okay with me until something like this happens. The sad irony is that through his shared loss and vulnerability, I found Richard utterly likable. I suppose in a classical sense, for any pilgrimage to reveal the full depth and breadth of its meaning, a certain amount of effort is required. Diligence, maybe even suffering. Think of walking the Camino de Santiago across northern Spain, or for a Muslim to make Hajj, pilgrimage to Mecca, or simply climbing to the top of a mountain. As anyone can attest who's ever climbed the 4-mile trail up from the Yosemite Valley floor to Glacier Point, the reward of that view can be most exhilarating and gratifying. But I would ask, does that very same view mean the same thing to the tourist who just stepped off the air-conditioned bus in the Glacier Point parking lot as it does to the one who so painstakingly climbed up from the valley floor, step by step by step? As with so many pursuits in life, I imagine our pursuit of spiritual inspiration and awakening can be tripped up by our expectations and assumptions. For instance, oh, Michael, if you ever get a chance to see the sunrise at Machu Picchu, it's absolutely transformational. Or if you ever get to meditate inside the burial chamber of the Great Pyramid in Egypt, it's absolutely life-changing. Well, for the 10-year-old boy for whom a bus ride to Artesia was an adventure, such promises leave my tongue wagging. But for the part of me that is wary of promises implicit in the whole idea of reaching one's goals, I have to return to my own hard-won wisdom, that if I knew what I was going to learn before I took this class, I never would have had to take the class. I have been fortunate to have made some of those fabled pilgrimages of the external variety, and I dream of making more. I did finally get to see the sunrise at Machu Picchu, and I did get to meditate inside the Great Pyramid. I've prayed at the Western Wall, and I've stood among the faithful on the banks of the Ganges. And in each instance, the sheer anticipation of spiritual inspiration, maybe even a touch of the mystical, was almost unbearable. And in each instance, I met with a certain disappointment, even stepping away from the moment, feeling a little disjointed. Hey, I was supposed to feel that. Where's my electric buzz from the touch of the magic sword? No, the gift and the magic in each journey, and it's always been there in spades, don't get me wrong. But it always came tiptoeing in through the side door while my focus and expectation were elsewhere. In September of 2011, I took a trip by myself to Peru to join a small hiking group hiking through the Sacred Valley, making our way to Machu Picchu. High in the Andes, we came upon a small village where we were scheduled to visit a school. Our guide, Peter, had even brought a couple soccer balls to give to the kids. But when we got to the school, we found it absolutely deserted, not a soul around. It's mid-morning on a school day. Where is everybody? Peter poked around the village a little bit and was told that one of the matriarchs of the village had died. She happened to be the mother of Enrique, who was one of the porters who worked for the same tour company as ours. The whole village had just stopped. Everyone went to the funeral, kids and everybody. Peter said, so let's go. I was feeling equally excited and fascinated and uncomfortable as hell to intrude on such a personal and sacred event. We climbed up this long, dusty dirt road up to the burial ground that was a small plot of earth framed by a low stone wall. The entire population of the village was contained in that wall. Peter went up to Enrique to offer his condolences, and Enrique immediately walked over to the three of us, standing outside the wall with our hiking poles in hand and our backpacks and our big hats to shield us from the Andean sun. And he invited us inside the wall. Well, that's it right there. Just being invited inside the wall. He even introduced me to his beautiful little boy who had just lost his grandmother. In my pathetic Spanish, I asked him about his abuela, and he answered me. And then Peter explained it was customary at these rituals to pass around a bottle of beer and for everyone to drink from the same bottle. But this being a Christian family, they were passing around a rancid bottle of soda and a dirty, rusty tin cup. And then the cup was offered to me. Uh-oh. I've got days of hiking ahead of me, Machu Picchu. I've been saving for months for this trip. It could all be ruined by this one sip. But how can I say no once I've been invited inside the wall? And so I drank, and I was fine. More than fine. They never explained communion, quite like that when I was taking catechism. A few years earlier, October of 07, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Egypt. After spending many days along the Upper Nile seeing the amazing splendors there, we spent a couple days in Cairo and had a day scheduled to drive out to Giza to see all the wondrous sights there. And that day it happened to be crushingly hot. Our guide, Hani Hamsa, offered us the option of climbing inside the Great Pyramid and climbing into the King's Burial Chamber. But he warned us that it's a very steep climb and a very tight tunnel, and you have to crouch in a near-crawling position. It can be very hot, very crowded, very claustrophobic. Scott opted out, choosing to wait in the air-conditioned car, and I said, there's no way I'm missing this. So I bought a ticket and went inside. Hani did not exaggerate. I assumed the posture for the long climb up, and I'm hitting my head on the roof of the tunnel every three steps and cursing a blue streak until I finally reach the chamber. What a relief just to stand erect after all of that. And then to truly try to grasp where I am in this moment. Hey, I made a cross-section model of this very pyramid in seventh grade social studies. Plywood, flour and water paste. It was brilliant. I got an A. And here I am. And of course, there are other tourists there behaving, in my view, inappropriately. Laughing, talking, carrying on, jumping into the empty stone sarcophagus in the middle of the chamber, posing for a selfie. I was getting righteously annoyed and feeling very spiritually superior. I was praying that the crowd might thin out so I might sit down and try to meditate. Happily, it did disperse a bit. I went over the corner and sat down right against the wall, got myself all situated, and took a few nice deep breaths. And I thought, you know, I have to go to the bathroom. No, I really have to go to the bathroom. Oh, Christ. And I got up. Excuse me. I made my way over to the entrance of the tunnel and I assumed the posture for the long descent down. And what better posture to try to hold it, mind you? I had this Japanese woman's ass in my face and I was just praying she could move those little pink tennis shoes a little more quickly. And I'm hanging on and I'm hanging on and I think, oh no, that's it. I'm going to crap my pants right here in the Great Pyramid. No, Michael, you can do it. Hang on. And then I see it, the proverbial light at the end of the tunnel. And I make my way to the opening and I ask the attendant, where's the toilet? And she points hundreds of yards across the hot desert sand. And I take off running like I have never run before. Scott told me later that Hani looked up from the car and said, look, there goes Michael running. In such a hurry. He's so fast. And I make it to the trailer. And of course, there's an attendant there who needs money to use the toilet and for a few pitiful pieces of toilet paper. And I just happened to have the right Egyptian coin in my pocket, and I made it without a nanosecond to spare. I have never felt gratitude quite like that. It was my own little Egyptian miracle. Talk about a sacred pilgrimage. Well, a few years ago, I was invited to speak at the Ventura Center for Spiritual Living, and I got there a little early and was having a lovely conversation with Reverend Bonnie, talking about all sorts of things, church ministry versus chaplaincy, and somehow we got on the subject of embarrassing stories and moments, and I told her that story. We had a big belly laugh and then decided we needed to focus on the service and who was going to do what and say what when, but not without Bonnie first commenting, Michael, I so enjoyed our conversation, particularly the mixture of the earthly and the sacred. And my question then, as it is now, is which is which? I've told that story many times, as you might imagine, since we went to Egypt, and it always gets a laugh of recognition. We've all been there. Annie Lamott calls laughter carbonated holiness. Is it possible that there's something more sacred in that shared laughter of recognition than there could ever be in any wisdom that's going to come to a guy like me meditating inside the Great Pyramid? Is it possible that there's a deeper sense of communion in that? Of all the destinations we've traveled, none has elicited more polarized and predictable responses from others than India. There were those when we were planning the trip I would tell who would swoon with envy and could share with me my excitement, anticipation. And there were those on the other side who, not without a little judgment in their voice, would comment, well, why would you ever want to go there? That's one place I have no desire to see. I hear it's absolutely filthy and the poverty is overwhelming. One comment that took me aback, I must say, is, Michael, haven't you had enough life-changing experiences? I guess not. Well, one day we had an impossibly long drive from Jaipur to Agra. Nearing lunchtime, our driver, Sonu, a lovely Sikh gentleman with limitless patience and calm, turned left off the main highway onto this choked side road that soon enough became dirt and then mud, leading into this small village where there was so much commotion and noise going on, horns honking from motorcycles and scooters and tuk-tuks, cows in the street, goats, garbage, people scrambling about, architecture that looked to be one step above a lean-to. And no matter how rural or impoverished the scene, there were always women draped in the most amazing colors and fabrics. We turned right into this nondescript driveway and were jettisoned into another universe altogether, something evoking the serenity of a French country estate. We got out of the car and walked down this long flagstone path framed by two rows of leafy green shade trees. At the end of the path was this lovely, formally designed Indian building in delicious decay, pink. And we turned left and we walked down another long flagstone path framed by another arcade of trees. And at the end of that path was another little pink building that was the restaurant where we would have our lunch. Turns out this is a small hotel for birders. The whole compound is a sanctuary for migrating fowl. All of this serenity is steps away from the kind of squalor one is used to seeing any given evening on the NBC Evening News behind Richard Engel reporting from some war-torn country or another. And I felt this familiar but uncomfortable awareness that I'm just not an observer of these stark contrasts. I am most definitely a participant. So do I quiet my conscience by reminding myself at least I'm here pumping a few dollars into the economy? At least I'm here bearing witness. I've spent some time wondering why it is that I love this kind of travel so much. Why would I spend so much money to travel down that mud road? The first stop on our itinerary was Mumbai. We landed there, spent a few days. One afternoon, our guide, Parvez, took us on a driving tour of the city, and she drove us through what she described was the wealthiest neighborhood in Mumbai, Malabar Hill. She was quoting astronomical prices for condos and flats in these sleek towers that were nevertheless sheathed with the grimy film of intractable pollution. But at street level, it looked like any other street in Mumbai. There was still garbage and cows and little shops in decay. It wasn't like it suddenly became Beverly Hills or Newport Beach. All manicured perfection. It was all messy as hell. There's simply no escaping the caste system made manifest. In each subsequent city that we visited, our guide would always ask where else in India we had been. And when we said that we started in Mumbai, without exception, they would swoon. Oh, Mumbai. Such a beautiful city, isn't it? Yes, it is. But it's a whole other kind of beauty. It's a beauty that's inclusive of the mess. It's not Paris. I remember in the late 60s, early 70s, one of my favorite attractions at Disneyland was the General Electric Carousel of Progress in Tomorrowland. I remember at the end of it, you walked up this long conveyor ramp that led to this platform where they revealed this dazzling animated model of the city of the future, where they were quick to point out the tunnels under the city for all the trucks, services, garbage collection, so no one would have to look at the mess. That's it right there. That is what I love about this travel so much, to be immersed. It's some of the same exhilaration I feel in my work, to be immersed in the messiness of life as it is. Unpredictable, uncontrollable, filled with the inevitability of loss. Every month, I facilitate a spiritual reflection group at the Sims Mann Center at UCLA, where I work. Not long ago, the conversation turned to some of the phenomena that some cancer patients face when they simply hit a wall with respect to their treatment. Sometimes ravaged by chemo and radiation, some will say, that's it, enough, no more. Time to let the disease take its course. And then their oncologist might say, but there's this new drug trial coming down the pike. Okay, I'm in. By way of an explanation, Loween, who always brings this quiet, gentle wisdom to the conversation, suggests that no matter how defeated we feel by life, she believes life calls to us. I love that, the simplicity of that, the profundity of that. Life calls to us. Life certainly called to every one of those villagers scrambling in the mud that afternoon. Life called to every one of the 8 or 10 men perilously huddled and perched on the rear bumper of a van barreling down the highway, clinging to the luggage rack as they clung to life. There is life force in the mess. And yet we in this culture have almost made a religion of denying the mess, deluding ourselves that life can or should be mess-free. Consider as an illustration the whole intention and design of a community like Irvine. No mess. When we got back, there were those who would call and ask, "So how was it?" And some would ask in a way that revealed far more of their own preconceptions than any genuine curiosity about mine. They would say, "Oh, I hear it's quite an assault on your senses and that the poverty's overwhelming. I'm sure it left you feeling so much gratitude for all that we have here, right?" Well, such sentiments couldn't be farther off the mark for me. That would be my essential takeaway message, gratitude for my blessings? That would seem kind of arrogant to suggest that because of some stroke of dumb luck or some benevolent force in the universe, I was born into this environment with these advantages and privileges and those poor folks were not. Gee, I must be God's favorite. Too bad for them. Now, of course, I'm profoundly grateful for my advantages and privileges, but I was grateful before we went to India. No, I think I invest the money in this kind of travel to be put deliberately into the state of unease with the messiness of life as it is. And I believe there's an element of sacred pilgrimage in that. Alice is in her mid-60s and has been living for many years with a very rare lymphoma, but more recently plagued by this necrotic wound on her leg that simply won't heal, goes right down to the exposed bone, causing her intractable pain. I was with her and her husband in the exam room when the nurse came in to clean out the wound and repack it in a vain attempt to save her leg. While she screamed in agony, I sat there just holding her hand, and I realized in that moment I had a choice to make. Am I going to look down and look at the wound? Am I going to look at the reality of what she's living with? Or am I going to choose to look away? When we got back, my mom asked, "How could you stay in nice hotels when there were so many people starving in the streets?" It's a fair question. But Mom, there's poverty just as fierce on so many streets in Los Angeles today. The thing is, we have the space and the room and the opportunity to look away. It can be blinding to contrast the American values we've all been force-fed with life in India or on Skid Row in Los Angeles or any other street in Los Angeles, to contrast that reality with those American values we've all been force-fed that you can be, do, and have anything you want if you're willing to work for it. Everything is possible. Such values have also been infused into so many of the religious traditions in which we've been raised. Ask, and it shall be given to you. With God, all things are possible. Or in a New Age sense, I only have to envision it and affirm it and claim it, and it will be mine. Back home and back to routine for a few days, I was driving home from work. I was listening to a podcast with Krista Tippett, a discussion between her and Paulo Coelho, the Brazilian author of the bestseller, The Alchemist, in which book he puts forth his theory that we're all here on earth to discover and live out our own personal legend. As I listened, I thought of those 8 or 10 men barreling down some dusty highway in Rajasthan on the back of a van, and suddenly his idea seemed hopelessly naive, maybe even a little ridiculous. And yet, a part of me believes it. After all, I'm an American who desires and wants more. I think most of us want more. We want to see more, love more, understand more, have more. And yet it may also be true that there is nowhere to go and nothing to become and nothing to get. T.S. Eliot reminds us the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. And I think, yeah, that's true. But don't I have to do the exploring first in order to understand this place? Maybe in the end, my mom was right, that we don't change so much from when and where we started. Or maybe costumes and scenery and a plot twist or two, but maybe in the most essential way, not. Might there be a kind of comfort to be found in that? A kind of peace of mind and heart that everything is not possible. That life and people have limitations. That maybe we are caught in our own caste system of sorts. I remember over 20 years ago, going through some intense psychotherapy and bemoaning to the therapist that I always seem to be returning to the same five or six issues, the same five or six themes over and over again, never getting anywhere. All she said was, "Aren't you glad there's only five or six?" I hold this image of myself at age 7, the age of reason. According to the Catholic tradition in which I was raised, the age at which we can supposedly discern the duality of life, right from wrong and good from evil, the age at which we participate in the sacrament of Holy Communion. And I wonder in the deepest possible way, am I still on that long pilgrimage to the altar, opening myself, preparing myself, to be ready at any given moment to step up and step out and receive Holy Communion with life? So be it. Thank you.